Coming up on the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, the debate that will not go away, evolution versus creationism. Why is Darwin's theory still so controversial?
Evolution is a great idea, but it's also a dangerous idea. It's an idea that threatens people's understanding of the way things are.
And a practicing Catholic who was once Hollywood's highest paid writer, specializing in sex and violence. He hit bottom, and then he says he was God-struck.
When you're absolutely cracked open and you're completely vulnerable and you're desolate.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As the economy continued to collapse this past week, there was sharp debate in Washington over the size and content of a stimulus package. Meanwhile, two of President Obama's nominees for top jobs bowed out because of their failure to pay some taxes. With all that controversy, no wonder the president urged reconciliation at the National Prayer Breakfast, as Kim Lawton reports.
At the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington Thursday, President Obama returned to a theme he's frequently repeated. He said while faith is all too often a point of controversy and division, it can also be a force for unity and healing.
I do believe that if we can talk to one another openly and honestly, and if perhaps we allow God's grace to enter into that space that lies between us, then the old rifts will start to mend. New partnerships will begin to emerge.
Obama officially announced his renamed and expanded Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, which he said would work on a variety of social issues to help achieve the common good.
The goal of this office will not be to favor one religious group over another, or even religious groups over secular groups. It will simply be to work on behalf of those organizations that want to work on behalf of our communities, and to do so without blurring the line that our founders wisely drew between church and state.
The office will be headed by Joshua Dubois, the 26-year-old Pentecostal minister who led religious outreach for Obama's presidential campaign. Part of his responsibilities will be organizing a diverse 25-member council of prominent religious and secular leaders to advise the president. Obama signed the executive order establishing the new office at a private White House meeting Thursday, attended by several of the new council members. There was much more fanfare when Obama signed a new law expanding government health insurance for low-income children. Faith groups across the spectrum had lobbied for the law, and many religious leaders attended the large East Room signing ceremony. President George W. Bush twice vetoed similar measures.
And Kim, the faith-based office is now supposed to do more than it did under President Bush?
President Obama's a former community organizer himself, and he says that faith-based groups and neighborhood groups are very well situated to deal with a whole host of problems. And so he set up this advisory council, and this office will not just funnel federal money to these faith-based groups, but they'll give him advice and policy development. So on issues like poverty reduction, AIDS in Africa, reducing the number of abortions, even interfaith dialogue, all of those issues will be under this office.
What about the question of hiring? Can a faith-based organization, if it wants to, continue to discriminate in hiring and hire only those people that believe the same things it does?
Well, that's a big controversy, and that's going to be argued out over the next few weeks. President Obama's administration is getting a lot of pressure from civil rights groups and strict church-state separationists to change this policy. Federal law says that religious groups can discriminate, only hire people who believe like they do, but it's unclear if they take federal money what should happen. And a lot of groups say that it violates the separation of church and state. However, the religious groups say that they need to be able to maintain their distinct religious identity, and they should only hire people who agree like they do. So, for example, on the issue of homosexuality, some of these religious groups don't want to be forced to hire gays and lesbians because they disagree with homosexuality.
There are a lot of clergy people on this new council. Is there a danger that they could be co-opted, that their closeness to the president could make them unable anymore to speak truth to power?
Well, some people have raised that. Will they still be prophetic, But the people I've been speaking with say that they see this as an opportunity to have a positive influence and to get religious values into the mix of the conversations. They say that this position will not prevent them from speaking out if they see something they don't agree with.
Kim Watton, many thanks. At the Vatican, church officials told a rehabilitated bishop that he must recant his denial of the Holocaust if he wants to be a clerical leader in the church. The demand comes after a storm of criticism from Jewish groups and others when Pope Benedict XVI allowed the bishop back into Catholicism. The bishop was one of four in a small, ultra-conservative movement who had been excommunicated because their group leader had consecrated them without Vatican approval. The top leaders of the worldwide Anglican Communion met in the ancient Egyptian city of Alexandria this week, and they could not agree about whether to recognize a conservative Anglican church in North America alongside the Episcopal Church. Many U.S. conservatives have left the Episcopal Church over concerns about doctrine and gay issues, but they still want to be part of the Anglican Communion. In a final statement, the archbishops renewed their call on member churches around the world to show, quote, gracious restraint when it comes to blessing same-sex unions and consecrating gay bishops. They also urged restraint in setting up affiliations between breakaway conservatives and Anglican churches in other parts of the world. Next Thursday, the 12th, is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln, and there will be many celebrations of his achievements. It's also the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin, and this year is the 150th anniversary of his transforming book on the origin of species. We have a special report today on Darwin's theory of evolution. That insight is almost universally accepted by scientists, but it directly contradicts the Bible's creation story, and so it remains under attack by many people of faith. Indeed, Americans are almost evenly divided between those who accept Darwin's theory and those who do not. Why is evolution still such a controversial idea? Fred DeSam Lazaro reports.
In the 1830s, Darwin collected data on the vast variety of living things while he was a naturalist with the British Navy on a 5-year trip around the world. He later theorized that the Earth was very old, that all life had evolved from simple organisms to the most complex. It followed that all humankind had evolved from a single ape-like ancestor. Kenneth Miller is a professor at Brown University.
Evolution is a great idea, but it's also a dangerous idea. It's an idea that threatens people's understanding of the way things are. For a century and a half, people who were bothered by that idea have never stopped hoping that Darwin might turn out to be spectacularly, colossally, totally, and completely wrong.
Francis Collins is an evangelical Christian who led the Human Genome Project to decipher the genetic code.
There's no greater flashpoint right now in the tensions between science and faith than evolution. Ever since Darwin's Origin of the Species was published, that tension has been flaring, and it seems, in my view, to be getting almost worse, even after all of these years.
Over many years of debate, people who accepted without question the Bible's account of God's creation, those sometimes called creationists, said Darwin's theory was heresy. Lauren Harsma teaches physics at Calvin College in Michigan and is the author of a new book called Origins.
Many people are raised to believe a certain interpretation of Genesis, which is mostly literal, not completely literal, but implies a young earth. And most people, when they hear the Genesis story of God creating everything, they picture God miraculously creating everything.
For some Christians, evolution became a synonym for atheism.
There are Christians who agree that evolution equals atheism, and since they believe in God, since they are convinced that God is real from their experiences of reading the Bible and worship and prayer, if God is true, they conclude evolution must be false. So that idea that you have to choose between evolution or God is, I think, the main source of problem, the main reason why this issue keeps coming up over and over again.
Some scientists also say part of the problem is misunderstanding about the meaning of the word theory. Matthew Hamilton teaches at Georgetown University.
The word theory is used very differently in common parlance. We might say something like, well, in theory, I'm supposed to leave work early today. And that would be a way of saying, well, I hope or I approximately think that this might be true. But in science, a theory is not a guess.
For scientists, a theory is a testable explanation of how things work based on observations and measurements. They say Darwin's overall theory is the best explanation for the facts, although there do remain some unexplained gaps in the evidence.
There are certain Christians who point to those areas and say, ah, here is scientific evidence against evolution. Scientists are worried about including too much emphasis on the gaps and the unknowns as a way of getting students to simply throw the whole theory out and say, ah, well, now I have a reason not to believe it. It's easy to see how evolution can produce variation, how it can produce adaptation to environments, but can it really make more complex life forms? That's an ongoing area of research. That's one of those places where we have a gap in our knowledge. We have hints, we have ideas, we have hypotheses. We don't have a lot of proofs. The other big unknown, of course, is how did the first life start? And that's the biggest question of all. Scientists are very far from a robust scientific explanation for how the first living cell came about. And so opponents of evolution point to that and say, maybe that's a place where there was a miracle.
Evolution critics use what they see as flaws in the evidence in their continuing but losing campaign to have creationism taught in the schools alongside evolution. More than 20 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that creationism could not be taught in science classes, that it was more religion than science, that teaching it in public schools would cross the line of separation between church and state. So creationists turned to other arguments.
There is, in fact, no entity in the known universe that stores and processes more information more efficiently than the DNA molecule.
One of them was that some forms of life are so complex that they must have been designed by an intelligent designer. That was at the heart of testimony in Dover, Pennsylvania.
We're going to argue that intelligent design is science. It is not religion.
But a federal judge ruled that intelligent design is not science and so should not be taught in science classes. This year, the battle shifted to Texas, where creationists want the State Board of Education to continue its long-standing requirement that students examine the, quote, strengths and weaknesses, unquote, of all scientific theories, including evolution.
Teaching students about the strengths and weaknesses of theories will engage their interest and turns a dry recitation of facts and propositions into an educational adventure.
And I challenge anybody to show me or anyone else specific, identified details on the weaknesses of evolution. Nobody has.
Despite the extremes of argument, many people of faith who are also scientists insist that evolution and religious belief need not conflict. For instance, they say God can work through evolution.
I think Christians are very, even Christians who oppose the theory of evolution, are comfortable saying God works through natural, scientifically understandable processes. If the majority of Christians could come to the place where they say, I might or might not believe in evolution, but it's okay for Christians to believe in evolution, that would take some of the weight off. On the other side, it would be very helpful if science educators could find better ways to discuss how different religious views might view evolution.
If God, who is outside space and time, chose to create a universe and populate it with creatures in his image with whom he could have fellowship, who are we to say that the process that we as scientists have uncovered, the Big Bang, the formation of stars and planets, and the mechanism of evolution to create life and ultimately human life, is not the way we would have done it? I find that enormously satisfying. Nothing that I know as a scientist is in contradiction to that. Nothing that I know as a believer is in contradiction to that.
Meanwhile, the debate continues, creationists versus evolutionists. Next month, the Texas Board of Education will decide whether the state's new science curriculum should continue to require discussion in science classes of the strengths and weaknesses of Darwin's idea. The vote is expected to be close. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam-Lazaro.
We have a Road to Damascus story today about a hard-living, cynical Hollywood writer who says he hit bottom one day and was transformed by God. He used to specialize in scripts full of sex, violence, and evil. Now he's a family man in Ohio. Our story is from Bob Fall.
Once dubbed by Time magazine America's king of sex and violence, Joe Esterhaz now bears the cross. This is more than ritual.
It's a very, very serious and the sacred moment to me.
You write, I carry the cross as though I were actually carrying Christ.
Yes.
Worshipping at Holy Angels Catholic Church in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, where he now lives, Esterhaz resembles only physically who he once was, Hollywood's highest paid screenwriter, churning out erotic sizzlers like Basic Instinct, where depravity, indeed evil, triumph.
Would you tell us the nature of your relationship with Mr. Boz?
I had sex with him for about a year and a half.
I was drawn to dark subjects and dark themes. And I wrote out of a very dark space at that particular point in my life.
The 16 films he wrote grossed over $1 billion, financed homes in Malibu and Maui, along with an outrageous lifestyle.
I've been a bad boy all my life. I was the king daddy of sex and violence, the wild hair, the rogue elephant, the drinking, drugging wild man, the cocaine cowboy.
No, that's all true. Yeah, I did do all that. The booze was out of control. The waking up in the morning and not knowing where I was or who I was with was out of control.
The alcohol and the cigarettes almost killed him in 2001. Doctors removed 80% of his cancerous larynx and inserted a trach for breathing. Unable to change his ways, high-flying Joe Esterhaz crashed.
It was probably the most desolate moment of my life, and a block away from here, I sat down on a curb, sweating, shaking, trying to get the bugs out of the trach, trying to breathe properly, and I started to cry.
Slumped on that curb, Esterhaz says he felt a dazzling presence, and he heard a voice within.
I kept hearing this voice saying, please God, help me. And I realized that it was my voice inside my head and that I was praying.
He was, he writes in his memoir, Crossbearer, God-struck. And the ultimate Hollywood animal who had scorned religion did not find God. God, he says, found him.
When you're absolutely cracked open and you're completely vulnerable and you're desolate, when I opened myself up to the possibility of God entering my heart, I think God did. That day, I was ambushed by God.
That recognition of weakness, says Rabbi David Wolpe, who has studied and written about how the desperate find faith, that recognition is the beginning of strength, even salvation.
I do think that great joy and great sadness or illness sort of crack open something inside you, and it makes you open to things that you, before that, thought were just absurd or ridiculous.
As somebody wrote, God comes through the wound. And, you know, sometimes it's not until we're really broken people that God has an entryway into our lives.
Father Dan Schlegel is Joe's priest at Holy Angels.
For Joe, I think that there were other gods before him, whether it was alcohol or whether it was power or money or prestige or whatever it was. And when all those things didn't work anymore and he was broken, in a sense, there's an openness for God to come in.
Joe Esterhaus had lived through radical change before, born in Hungary during the Second World War. He spent nearly 5 years in refugee camps. But the change which began on that sidewalk in 2001, his wife Naomi recalls, took some adjustment.
His transformation, to use that phrase, was so gradual. It was very gradual. Joe is a cynic. He's had a very, he had a hard life. You know, he ate pine needle soup in the refugee camps. He was scalded in the refugee camps. He had rickets. He lived in abject poverty. So when he first took those baby steps toward God, it wasn't without cynicism. I think he went, okay, I'm going to go down this road.
For Esterhaus, that road meant, with his entire family, starting to attend church weekly, also reading and studying widely about God and theology. Still, he found himself unsure, tentative, even wary, until one Sunday when his former priest, Father Bob Steck, approached him after a service.
I was literally just drawn to stop and simply share with him a simple phrase, "Joe, the best is yet to come," with a message of hope, a message of assurance that it was going to be okay. As if God said, Joe needs to hear these words today.
Through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Now, devoted to his wife and four young sons, and pronounced cured of cancer by his doctors, Joe Esterhaus says life has never been better.
I think he's more careful. He's more Christian. He's more less cynical and more willing to believe the goodness in people than he is the darkness. I always tell him, you've been co-opted by God, and now you're working for him because you used to dance with the devil.
The question you would ask yourself then is, why do I deserve to be singled out like this?
I don't know why God has blessed me and graced me the way God has. In terms of my own view of my life, it's something miraculous. I thank God for gracing me. I always will, but in my own mind, I don't deserve it.
And it is that sense of mystery, even wonder, which he conveys at public readings of the book he subtitles A Memoir of Faith.
This is how I found God, or how God found me.
Recently, Esterhaus has completed 2 screenplays, each one a thriller, but neither focusing on the perverse or the tormented.
You can't write blood and hair on the walls with God in your heart.
Yeah. You know, to get involved in that thought process, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that.
Walking with his wife, or alone, 3 times every day, Joe Esterhaus prays, mostly what he calls thank you prayers.
I pray for God's presence to be in my heart, to continue to be in my heart.
What I tell people to pray for who are in trouble is closeness, is to not be alone, is to feel that God is with you. That prayer, that's a powerful prayer. That's a real prayer, and that's a prayer that I believe gets answered.
And 7 years after being what he calls God-struck, Joe Esterhaus, a lifelong skeptic, has no doubts that his prayers have been heard.
I think questioning and doubt are good. And I think they build faith. In my own particular case, 7 years down the line, I can say to you that my life has been transformed, and I find a sense of solace and strength that simply wasn't in my life before.
Joe Esterhaus, then, born anew, from Malibu to Ohio, Jack Daniels to Sprite, Sharon Stone to Jesus, from darkness into light. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faugh in Chagrin Falls, Ohio.
On our calendar, the Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat begins at sundown on Sunday It's called the New Year for Trees and has become a day to celebrate environmental stewardship. Finally, Millard Fuller died this past week. He was a Christian businessman who founded Habitat for Humanity, which uses donated materials and volunteer labor to build houses for the poor. Habitat makes no profit, and the buyers pay no interest.
You know, the great monotheistic religions of the world are Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And in all of those monotheistic religions, there is the common teaching that you shouldn't charge interest to the poor. And we don't charge interest in Habitat for Humanity, and that makes the houses affordable. We call it the Bible Finance Plan.
Since 1976, Habitat has built 300,000 homes for 1.5 million people in 100 countries.
We believe that God's love extends to all people. Whether you're Christian or Muslim or Jew or Buddhist or confused, whatever you might be.
Millard Fuller was 74 years old. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more on religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from last week's installation ceremony in Moscow of Patriarch Kirill, the new leader of the Russian Orthodox Church.